Now, we are going to look at this, the way in which the coronavirus pandemic throws the best sort of spotlight on mainstream journalism, giving it a chance, one could argue, to rebuild trust and support. So said Alan Rusbridger, the former editor-in-chief of The Guardian, in his latest column for that paper. How many, he wrote, of our loved ones die in this pandemic is to a great extent reliant on what people believe to be the truth. The penny seems to be dropping in some quarters that journalism can be a matter of life and death in the sense of providing vital, reliable information. And for the UK, of course, that life and death scenario is a tragically everyday account. The death toll now exceeds 40,000 people. Alan Rusbridger is one experienced observer, and I'm delighted he could join us. He led The Guardian for 20 years until 2015, and just this month was appointed to Facebook's new Global Oversight Board, which we'll also talk to him about as well. Thank you for your time, Alan.
That's okay.
Now, before we tackle this broader question of the media, could we glimpse through your eyes the mood of the UK at the moment? I mean, there's a lot of connection, as you know, to Australia. And from this perspective, I have to say, with great regret, the UK seems rattled, if I can put it like that. That sort of tremendous spirit's there, as if it's the Blitz all over again. But in terms of authority, the sense of information being given, it doesn't look to me as if the place is under control. Is that what it feels like?
I think that's fair. I think we've moved from a situation of taking pot shots at Italy and Spain and others of our neighbours for the way they were handling this, and then suddenly realising that we had leapfrogged over them and are now in the unenviable position of being just behind the United States in the number of deaths. And the messaging from this government has been so confused. So there's briefing that we were all going to be tasting freedom this week, and then within 24 hours that had been reversed. And I think there's a widespread perception that we were too late to take this seriously. So I think what you're speaking of is a nation that's very divided. There are some people who are itching to get back to normality. But I think there are more people who are quite fearful and can see that if you move too quickly, the likelihood is you're going to be in even deeper trouble.
Well, yes, it's, you know, a very interesting piece by a man called Ian Birrell, writing in that online journal Unheard, said that in a way you do wonder, with the great need for clarity, it's odd that such an effective team of campaigners who pulled off Brexit and a big election victory against the odds have managed to create such a public relations calamity. And it is in the next sort of part of your thinking, you think, well, maybe they have been affected themselves by the virus. Clearly, Boris Johnson, Dominic Cummings, his key Downing Street advisor, was collapsed and was in bed for 10 days. And the Cabinet Secretary and Civil Service Chief, Sir Mark Sedwill, also caught the disease. I mean, you know, maybe.
And the Health Secretary.
Matt Hancock,
yeah.
So is that what we're partly watching?
Well, that would be a charitable explanation and perfectly plausible. I mean, you could say that this is, it can be a very serious disease, and obviously Boris Johnson had it very badly. And in no other walk of life, I think, would you be expecting him to be back at his desk as quickly as he was. He does look worn out, and his performances in the House of Commons have not been great. So, I mean, that would be a charitable explanation, but I think the roots of it go further back.
What's an uncharitable explanation?
Well, I mean, almost the moment he got into power, his right-hand man, Dominic Cummings, who is an oddball, clever guy who was behind the messaging of Brexit but operates in the shadows, was in the habit of making government announcements through private briefings and getting stuff onto Twitter rather than the more straightforward route of publishing information openly and of having open and forthright press conferences. So what you've got at the moment is the scientific group, SAGE, meeting. Until recently, we weren't even allowed to know who the members were. The advice is not being published in full. The minutes are not being published in full. And instead of which, you have the feeling that they're continuing this bad habit of briefing selected journalists privately. and therefore being completely unaccountable for the message, the confused messages that are coming out. I think that's equally to blame for the situation we're in.
Yes, I mean, look, just on a human scale, you think that there was Boris Johnson wanting so much to be like his idol, Winston Churchill, presiding over a huge challenge. But the challenge, you can't order up your challenges, can you? The challenge he gets is a completely different one to the one that faced Churchill, and maybe it's found him out.
I think so. I mean, when the history books come to be written, there are these odd moments where Johnson just goes completely missing. You know, I mean, we know at the beginning of the year he was having a long holiday in Mustique. We don't know quite who paid for that. And then he comes back and then he's away again for 2 weeks in February at a time when he's getting divorced. And it looks as though his eye wasn't on the ball then. I remember people writing at the time, this was before people really concentrating on the disease, saying, you know, where on earth is the Prime Minister? And then another period in mid-March when other nations were beginning to act decisively. And it wasn't until right at the end of March that the British government really got its act into gear. So this is not very Churchillian, I think, but this will be for the eventual inquiry.
Well, yes, I mean, it does seem astounding to us that the UK has only now moved to do any sort of border control for the virus. Even then, it's just to require, and I don't think it's even coming in straight away, arriving in the UK to go into self-isolation just for themselves. You know, they do it for 2 weeks, and I don't even think, I think the French are exempted.
Well, possibly. We haven't learned that definitively yet. And the story on tracking and tracing has not been a happy one. I mean, incredibly slow to get that going, still not operating at anything like the capacity that it should be. A muddle about the tracing app. At one point, we were building our own app because we didn't want to use the app that everybody else was using. But it's now not clear if that app works quite in the way that they hoped. So at every stage, you've got a story of confusion and acting too slowly.
Look, I think this is a very interesting time for the media. And you've said that there's all sorts of opportunities for the media we haven't had for a while. But, and I'd like to test your thoughts, because it certainly struck me, that is it incumbent upon journalists at a time of such a crucially important time for so many people, that the media doesn't willfully show people in authority to be useless or complete dopes, because surely it is in the interests of the community to have some trust in the people who govern them, that there is an extra responsibility to both hold people to account, but not to willfully make them look stupid? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, trust isn't earned by people in the media distorting the picture or fawning over politicians. That's not the way trust is earned. Trust is earned by looking unflinchingly at the evidence and using the craft of journalism to, at its best, to put facts into the public domain. So I think the job of the journalist has to be calm, realizing that lives may depend on what we write or broadcast, not to either varnish what's going on or to embellish it or sensationalize it. So I think it's a time for calmness, but it's certainly not a time to suspend our critical feelings because we're all in a moment of crisis.
Mm. Is there an extra need for ensuring that you portray competence and success as well as showing up the flaws in the management? I just wonder if you've been reflecting on this sort of some of the codes and the etiquette, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. And I think fairness in reporting is an important thing, so that if there are success stories, you have to write about them and you have to write about the people who are behaving heroically in the situation in which we're in, and to find stories of courage and clear thinking, whether that's from frontline nurses or people working to keep the food chain supplied or the nation's scientists. So there is lots to praise and be proud of, and I think a fair approach would be to reflect both.
Mm. You say that this is the media's moment. Why are you seeing that?
Well, I think the communication of the situation we're in the moment is incredibly important. So we live in a world at the moment of information chaos, where you can find literally a million versions of what to think or what to believe. And therefore, the mainstream media ought to be the people who can step forward and say, look, we are the ones that you can trust. And here is the craft that we practice. And on how we report this, lives will depend. Because if we get carried away and misreport it or get guided by our prejudices, then wrong decisions will be taken, the population will be misled, and bad things will follow. So it's an incredibly important moment, really the most crucial moment that I can remember, in which how the story is told will be so crucial in affecting literally whether people live or die.
And what are the noteworthy examples you could talk about? Of good journalism.
Well, there's been, I mean, there's some of the scientific and health writing from people who really know what they're talking about and who can help us interpret what is rather complicated scientific position has been exemplary. Some of the political reporting are telling us a little bit about the chaos behind the scenes is important to know. And I think the people who really come into their own are the brilliant sort of data collectors. So whereas the government has been rather shy about publishing agreed sets of data so that we can judge exactly how we're performing and whether the figures that we're being told, how they compare with other countries, but also it was really the work of newspapers that said, well, hold on a minute, these figures that you're announcing about hospital deaths are only part of the picture. And we have to look at deaths in care homes, and then we have to look at unexplained deaths, that the deaths that are happening that weren't happening last year. So that you've got a much more complete picture than the politicians who, you know, of course, will want to underestimate and minimise the peril we're in.
But what if they're actually doing a good job? I suppose it's interesting that you've cited, you know, you haven't put them in the group of people who've done it all well. I suppose that's, isn't it important for the media to also recognise where the people in power are doing a good job?
Well, I think where you see it, yes. I mean, I think most people think the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, has risen to the challenge. I mean, he's been decisive. He has opened the coffers. He's made two very decisive interventions on the job retention scheme in order to furlough people and keep them in jobs so that the employment position doesn't collapse as well as the health position. And I think he's got lots of credit for that. I think people are more sceptical about how the health position has been handled.
Mm. And what about experts? I mean, would you say that some of them, I think the BBC is in particular sort of done, I think perceived to have done very well by bringing a lot of people through who've given information that people can really trust?
Well, the irony is that it was only a couple of months ago that the government was really trying to dismantle the whole funding basis for the BBC. And Dominic Cummings really believes that Fox News and talk radio are better than what he would think of as sort of socialized broadcasting companies. And the BBC was in real peril, I think, a story that will be familiar to the ABC.
Yes.
Well, I don't think anybody thinks that now. I mean, you look at the performance of Fox News, which has been lamentable in the United States, whereas levels of trust in the reporting of the BBC, which is, for all its weaknesses, which we could argue about on a later day, it is a very well-resourced and professional and trusted news organization.
Look, I have to ask you about this other role you have. You're one of 20 inaugural members of a Facebook Global Oversight Board, and that's just been announced this month with, I think, $130 million has been pledged. I think that's the figure, over a little while, and you're supposed to find 20 more on this board. Could you tell us a little about what the board will do and how, please?
Yeah, well, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, which is the information chaos that we live in, and Facebook is a big part of that. We know that. It's as well as being all the good things that we love about Facebook, those of us who are on it, it has been, I think, slow to grasp the enormity of the misinformation that is spread. And this is the first attempt that I've seen of a big tech company to say, well, actually, we need some help here because the decisions that have to be taken are really beyond the scope of the brilliant engineers that we employ. So the idea is that we act as a kind of, I mean, people
Supreme
are calling
Court,
it a kind of
I think,
Supreme
actually,
Court.
Mark Zuckerberg's talking.
That may be rather grand terminology, but nevertheless, that the types of cases, it's not a magistrate's court, so we're not doing the speeding tickets and the day-to-day adjudications, but we are looking at that, the pattern of cases that are most troublesome and trying to give guidance, which Facebook has promised they will implement.
And it hasn't been tested yet. We don't know whether they will, do we?
We don't know, but it's been a very high-profile thing by Zuckerberg himself. And so I think if Facebook were to start ignoring the work that this board did, then I think it would be terribly damaging for them.
Mm. That's fascinating. I mean, finally, you know, we've got stories here about News Limited, News Corporation, for instance, probably going to stop printing a swathe of their papers in regional and community publications, even though they fundamentally believe the local is so important. But they're going to keep the big mastheads printed, it would seem, and the smaller ones are going to just go online. And no one really knows yet how that's going to work. So that's, you know, in some ways the worst of times. And then a lot of them, you know, the big media outlets putting out their hand for money from the governments who've half pledged, yes, it's not entirely clear what sort of money is coming. And yet you think that this is a very decisive moment in the way citizens think of mainstream news, because in a way this COVID is a dress rehearsal for covering climate change.
Yes, I think, we know that the economic model for news is in crisis, and this is the moment at which journalists have to prove that what we do is worth paying for in some way. You know, whoever's going to pay for it, we have to prove that what we do is worthy of the kind of support that it needs. Now, I think that journalism at its best is a public service. It's like a police service or an ambulance service. You can't have societies that don't have an agreed basis of fact. That doesn't work. You can't have law. You can't have science. And we can see that the picture of climate change is a bit like a virus. We kind of know what the story is going to be over the next 30 years. The question is whether we can convince people and governments to act. Now, in the past, the story on climate change has not been a happy one with a lot of the media. They've either neglected the story or distorted it. And so you have to ask, well, why would we bail out or sustain or subsidize or pay for media that tells us wrong things? So I think the media has to get serious and say, yes, we're willing to step up to this public service role. The entertainment bit of media is less important. I think the opinion bit of media is less important. What matters most is reliable reporting. And if we can rise to that challenge now, then I think we will make the case for survival. But it's going to be difficult.
Well, I hope you're right. Thank you very much indeed for offering those thoughts.
It's good to talk. And I hope you stay safe.
Alan Rossbridger, I hope you do too. He is former editor-in-chief of The Guardian, member of this new Facebook oversight board, which will be very interesting to watch, principal of Oxford University's Lady Margaret Hall and chair of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. So rather involved.